Welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Hello, my dear audience. Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Micro. As always, I hope you had a great week. And of course, you can always find Let's Talk Micro on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Goodpods. Wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find Let's Talk Micro. As for our social media, I am on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube as Let's Talk Micro, on LinkedIn as Luis Plaza, on X as Let's Talk Micro 1, on YouTube as Let's Talk Micro, and I have an email address which is letstalkmicro@outlook.com. So either via social media or via email, you can always reach out with any suggestions, any feedback. They are always welcome and appreciated. So please go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, download episodes, and if the app allows you to do so, please go ahead and leave a review. But thank you so much for your support. And the Let's Talk Micro podcast is a podcast that does not have any sponsors. So if you want to support it anyway, there is a Venmo link, and there's also a Buy Me a Coffee, KOFI, both links available on the show notes. If you are looking to learn more about antibiotics, please check out www.learnantibiotics.com and the Learn Antibiotics book available on Amazon. These resources include cheat sheets, practice tests, games, and more, and they are being used by thousands of people worldwide and may be helpful for you or your colleagues. Great resources from Dr. Timothy Gauthier, a very passionate pharmacist. And if you haven't listened to the previous episode, please go ahead and do so. It was about the dengue virus. And in this episode, I was joined by Dr. Rodney Rohde. He's a recurring guest. And he came into the podcast to talk about dengue. And of course, as we always do in Let's Talk Micro, we like to explain things. So we started from the basics. So Dr. Rohde started with what type of virus it is. Then he talked about vectors. He talked about signs and symptoms. Of course, he also talked about prevention and treatment. He also talked about a vaccine, and he also mentioned some areas that are seeing higher amount of cases. So I think this was a great episode. And Dr. Rohde, from time to time, he does some explainer articles, which can be, you know, typically with a virus, about a disease. And they're very informative. You know, they're a great way to put everything together. So he definitely did one about dengue, and that's how I reached out to him, and he talked about it, and I included the link in the show notes for you to read. All in all, it was a great episode, so definitely check it out if you haven't already. Well, let's go ahead and move on to today's episode, which is about being certified in clinical microbiology. And as you know, those of you that work in the bench, that work in clinical microbiology, in order to work in a laboratory, you have to be certified. And there are some different certifying agencies out there, but today's episode is about the certification from the ASCP, which is the American Society for Clinical Pathology. And that is a national certification, which if you work in a state that requires licensure, they take that as your test for you to get certified. So in this episode, I was joined by Dr. Amanda Harrington, and she's a director at a lab in Loyola Medicine, and she's also an educator. And she joined the podcast to talk about the different ways that you can be certified as a microbiologist in the laboratory. And of course, those of you that are medical laboratory scientists, you know that the most classical one is that you complete a program, right? Like I did, and many of you in the audience have done. And then at the end, you take a test, and then you get certified in the different areas of the lab. So in the episode, she talks about that, and she also talks about categorical certifications, where you can be certified in just the one area, and in this case, microbiology. So she goes over that. And then she also talks about the specialist in microbiology certification. So in the episode, she goes over the requirements, she talks about the exam, and I bring a question, which is, those of you that might have taken it or are getting ready to take it, you see that some of the requirements are experience in different areas. And that might be challenging in some areas, especially if you're working in a place where maybe all you do is bacteriology and you don't have access to parasitology, mycology, and those areas. So I asked that question and she goes over that. So this was definitely a great episode and it really shed some light, as I said in the episode, and it helped me also because I've been looking to take it, but I've been so busy. But at the same time, you know, I had some questions like that about the experience. So it was definitely great chatting with her. All in all, a great episode. So let's go ahead and listen to it.
So this episode is actually a request of a listener, and I actually had it on my list to get to it. And I'm happy that it is happening. And I get to talk about this because this is something that it not only, you know, it's interesting to you, the audience, but to me as well, that I am a medical laboratory scientist working in the field. And you're familiar, I'm sure that, you know, a lot of you, especially in the workforce already, you're familiar with the ASCP, and which is the American Society for Clinical Pathology. And today we're going to talk about some certifications. So we're going to try to break it down as we do in Let's Talk Micro. So with me today to do that, I have a guest. And her name is Dr. Amanda Harrington. Dr. Harrington, welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Thank you so much for having me today.
My pleasure. Thank you for taking the time. So let's start with a quick, you know, I told the audience your name. So let's start with a quick introduction about what you do and anything else that you want to tell the audience.
Yeah, thanks. I am a director of a clinical microbiology lab. I'm here at Loyola Medicine outside of Chicago. We're a 3-hospital system. We have 1 academic medical center that does, you know, tertiary and quaternary care, a lot of complex patients with transplant and cancer. And we have a really busy emergency department. We have a very, one of the only burn units here in the state of Illinois. So really complex patients. And then our other 2 hospitals are more community-based. I am also lucky enough to be one of the faculty members involved in our medical laboratory science program. So we get to work with the newest and brightest folks in our field. And I work with the university, you know, training medical students. I get to work with the pathology residents here. So I feel like education is a big component of what I do here at Loyola.
I thank you for that. And as you were saying that, you know, it's definitely, you know, as an educator, it's now that, you know, recently classes just started. And like, for example, me, I'm the 2nd week of the lab program that I teach. So it's always very fascinating when you get those new faces and they're starting to getting familiar with, you know, getting again once you to the microscope and doing gram stains and putting all those concepts together. It's always definitely for me, training or teaching it's a very exciting. So for the audience, and as I said in the beginning, if you're working in a lab, more than likely you're familiar with the American Society for Clinical Pathology. Sometimes, you know, as you're going into the program in a program like a medical laboratory sciences program, maybe you'll start learning about it, but you might not be aware of it. So let's start with a brief overview of what's the American Society for Clinical Pathology.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think especially for students, right, when we're in a structured MLS program, one of the big goals is to become a certified medical laboratory scientist. But, you know, there's a lot of ways to be involved in the field outside of just that one pathway. So we'll talk about that a little bit more. But the ASCP, or American Society for Clinical Pathology, was formed in 1922. But what we really want to talk about today is the certification process, which is a little bit different. So the first registry for certification was created in 1928, and that was called the Registration Bureau for Technicians, or it was referred to as the ASCP Board of Registry. And the reason I want to kind of backtrack through history, although it's a little bit boring, but what we're named and what we call ourselves is really important. So I kind of wanted to take a step back. So the first Board of Registry, or the BOR, as people have come to kind of know it, Board of Registry, certificates were issued, you know, not long after that. So starting in like the 1930s. And that's when we first started to call ourselves in the field. And when I say us, I mean everybody. I'm actually what wasn't trained as a medical laboratory scientist, but putting myself in that bucket at the moment. So anyway, when we started calling ourselves medical technician, and that's where you started to see MT after people's names to designate that training and certification. It was a way to separate our field and show that level of expertise. And then that evolved to where we started to call this the Registry of Medical Technologists. So that was still early on in the 30s and 40s. You can start to see that shift from technician to technologist. And so that's around the same time we start establishing our curricula, what we want people to know in the field. And then in the 1950s, we start to see the evolution of specialty training. And so that's really, we're going to talk a little bit more today, you know, how you work specifically in micro, and those certifications start to emerge. And so LabMed, of course, you know, just throughout that time, that was kind of an explosion for our field, really. And the field just starts to diversify in general. And so several societies are growing up, you know, in parallel and around the same time, and start to form partnerships with the ASCP Board of Registry, because it's really important to have, you know, that registration and keep that quality of education and certification up to date. So really, we start to see several partnerships happen at that time. One example is AACC, which is now ADLM, or where our clinical chemists typically are. And so the big shift for this, the big change really came in the late 2000s. And so the Board of Registry, which was under ASCP, and the National Credentialing Agency for Laboratory Personnel formed a single certification agency, which is now called the Board of Certification. And that's what we all know now as where we go to get our certification. So the ASCP BOC, or the Board of Certification. So it is a credentialing agency, and it's not the only one, but it is a big one, and one we're probably most familiar with, that partners with many other societies that help shape that Board of Certification. So that's where I get to come in as a member of the American Society for Microbiology. I'm lucky enough to be a member of the Board of Governors for this Board of Certification, with many other participating and sponsoring societies. And these groups come together, so chemistry, genetics, blood banking, and transfusion, except now they're bio, I'm going to get it wrong, bioproducts. They just changed their name not too long ago. Anyway, all of those groups come together and shape the practices and policies where we all are now certifying. So that is the evolution of the ASCP Board of Certification. And actually, I think it's really important for everyone to know, not just, you know, from a fundamental standpoint, but also from an administrative standpoint, the BOC, the Board of Certification, is separate from ASCP. So that's a little confusing sometimes. You'll go on the website, you can see some things kind of maybe see like it's just one big thing, but they're actually two separate independent groups. Of course, they have ties and communication and all of those pieces, but the Board of Certification is actually separate. They have a separate website, and hopefully you can find a lot of information on that website. So I hope that helps.
It definitely did, and thank you for that. It's always, you know, great. I love, like, you know, historical backgrounds and getting some perspective and going back. That way we kind of understand where things are coming from, and it's great. So definitely thank you. Yeah, well, that BOC and those in the lab, we're familiar with it, and I think mine is coming next May, every 3 years. So about some ways that you can be certified, and of course, you know, there's the classic one that, well, you can be certified as a technology in microbiology, which is what a lot of us, you know, myself and people in the audience, I'm sure, that you complete a medical laboratory sciences program. And then, you know, it's geared as you're taking your courses, you're doing your practicals, and you're getting to reviewing towards that test. You take it, you pass, and you get certified in all the major areas of the lab, including microbiology. But there are actually other ways that a person can be certified, right? So can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that is the traditional route, that as the, you know, the medical laboratory science route, like you said, where you're eligible and certified to work in all areas of the lab. But then we have what you mentioned as specialty training. So that's where you can work, you can be trained and certified just in a limited area, which I find just such a benefit for microbiology. So there are when it comes to certification, we refer to these as the categorical certifications, meaning really that specific area of the lab. So we'll just talk about micro today. And so you'll see on the website, and I think it can get a little bit confusing, but there are a number of different routes. And we can talk a little bit more about what the routes mean in just a bit. But there are two pretty common ways that people come in to specialty training and to be eligible for categorical certification. One is that which is through Route 2, is that you have an undergrad degree in science, and typically that's biology or chemistry. But for any English majors listening, that's okay too. You just need the required number of science hours, where it's really about the science hours. And you need 1 year of training in an accredited clinical lab. And we call that the experience route. So you've come in with the prerequisite education in terms of science, and then you've spent a year training in an accredited laboratory. And then you are then eligible to take the examination for that categorical certification in microbiology. The other route, the other common route, Route 3, is a structured program route. And that is really successful completion of a structured program under a NAACLS, NAACLS accredited MLS program. And so there's an educational component, and there are some clinical rotations that are required. And typically, that's a set of structured classes that prepare you in that area, and then those observation pieces. And so there are a couple of different online programs or categorical training programs throughout the U.S. One is University of Cincinnati. Loyola actually just launched a categorical training program, and I know George Washington and Weber State also have online programs that make you eligible through this route. They provide the requisite training. The challenge in some cases for categorical certification through Route 3 is that sometimes it's hard to find those lab rotations, those clinical micro rotation spots that are needed for this route. So so that can also be a hurdle. And so I think this on-the-job experience route has sometimes been a little bit more accessible, depending on what the available pieces are to the person who's seeking training.
I like that you mentioned that. And at least in my experience in the areas that I've, the years that I've been working, I haven't had, I haven't met people that have gone, that way. And I like that you're saying, like I said, it's difficult. And even, I remember, I knew of someone that person was actually encouraged to go to an actual program and then did the training. So person had to go to school for a year and a half. I remember the Weber one, and I met one person in our lab that was actually enrolled in that program, and he was doing his rotations through there. So is that that brings me to my next question. So, I mentioned I haven't seen a lot of people doing that, and now there seem to be more programs and the increase for that. But are we seeing more people using those routes as far as you know?
Yeah, I think so. And I don't have hard data to show you. It's more anecdotal. And I think probably those data are available, but not publicly available. But we know that people are using those categorical routes, either through the training programs or on the job training. And really, this has been an excellent avenue for talented people with curious minds to find their way to lab medicine and microbiology specifically. Almost universally, when we talk to biology grads, they didn't know the field existed or that this job existed. And a lot of times they didn't know there were training programs available. So we have, scientific minds just ready to go, and they really just didn't know about us. So they're out looking for a job. And so a lot of those people, if you have eligibility and space to hire them, right, assuming that your laboratory will hire an uncertified or a person who hasn't been trained in medical laboratory science, that's an excellent route to bring people in through the experience route. We don't have enough graduating medical laboratory scientists to fill all the open positions that we need in micro and in lab medicine in general. I think there's been kind of a perception in the field that programs are closing, and that's why there aren't enough medical laboratory scientists. And I think the data show that the number of programs have stabilized and are potentially increasing. But either way, we're still not graduating enough people from those programs to fill our spots. So this is really, these categorical routes are really an opportunity for labs to find a source of new talent for these positions as well. I think one other point that would be really great to make is that in addition to microbiology, we've really seen categorical certification grow in molecular biology as well. And that makes a lot of sense after COVID because we pulled a lot of people into testing and now they're looking for opportunities to continue to grow and progress in the field. And certification is really one of those benchmarks that they can demonstrate, you know, their expertise and training. So we've seen, I think we're seeing micro and molecular biology grow for sure.
Yeah, and I think always, you know, the lack of awareness is always an ongoing challenge that we have in this field from MLS programs and people finding about the profession. And it's definitely, you get a lot of students that, you know, they already have a degree and then they found out and then they, you know, come back to get that profession. But yeah, it's definitely, it's challenging to get people. And even, you know, depending on the size of the program, and for example, that we, you know, we graduate 30 students every year, and maybe out of those 30, we get one or two that end up in micro. A lot of people tend to go to the generalist side to get like a general experience, and then maybe decide, okay, I want to do something else. But yeah, it's definitely challenging to fill those positions.
Yeah, I agree. Just being visible, and you know, throughout the U.S., you might have a spot open, but your HR won't let you hire someone into that job position, or you might be able to get someone hired, but you're not really sure how to do on the job training. So it's not as easy as it sounds to help people be successful in these categorical routes. I think the structured programs are really an advantage because they have that built-in curricula. They're telling you these are the building blocks you need and they're available. But again, sometimes finding a spot to do the clinical rotations can be challenging as well. So if we want people to come into the field, we really need to try to make it a little bit easier to help them get there. And that's challenging, I think.
Definitely. So as far as then, and now we talked about the, you know, like getting certified in microbiology. So now we know that there are some specialist exams. So let's talk about the specialist in microbiology certification. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So the specialist certification is really knowledge that's above and beyond an entry level medical laboratory scientist. And some people have an MLS certification and then go on to specialize in certain areas that they maybe have worked in. Like you said, people train and then specialize, you know, when they go on the job. Some folks have just gone through the categorical training and certification and then go on to be specialists. But that specialist certification, again, like the other ASCP certifications, there are different routes or eligibilities or qualifications to get there, but typically it's about years of experience. And then it may or may not be master level or doctoral degree. So there are a couple of different, you know, entry paths into a specialist certification possible. And again, you can find these on the website and they'll list out exactly which pieces of the puzzle you need, but really it's that experience piece, right? This is above and beyond just that foundational knowledge that you need at the bench. And really there's problem solving and quality control and a lot of those pieces that demonstrate that extended level of knowledge.
And as far as, does it give you, you know, any advantage in the workforce? I mean, if people are looking at it, is there like, does it put you ahead somewhere, or is there like a benefit? I mean, of course, as a nerd and a microbiologist, and I completely understand what you're saying. But some people, you know, might be, okay, so if I take this, you know, does it help me in the workforce? So I guess that's my question. Is there like an advantage to this?
That's a great question. And you're right. I think a lot of people go on to get the specialist certification for professional satisfaction as a way to just say, yes, I did this and I really want to set myself, you know, above. I think, you know, hands down, those who go on to seek that level of certification have demonstrated proficiency and expertise in the field. And often they are our leaders in our laboratories and educational programs. So I think it is an avenue. And of course, it's always system dependent, right? So I can't say across the board, but I think the people who are willing to take the next step to say, yes, I have extra expertise in this area, or I'm proficient in this area, are a lot of those folks who get moved into positions of leadership, who are our teachers, because they're lifelong learners. So hopefully that's being financially rewarded. I don't have data to share about that, but I think that's the idea, right? That it helps you demonstrate your qualifications and talents.
Okay. And for the listeners, you know, I will put the link to the AACP so they can definitely research this in more detail and get more information. And this question, you know, I do, and I'm there have been some points, and the listeners know right now I'm doing a lot of things at once. But, and I have considered, you know, taking it myself. I don't have it in my credentials yet, and I have considered it. I have done research some periods in time, but I have to admit that I haven't really looked at it in detail. So this is a question that I wanted to ask. As far as the experience, and because sometimes, you know, with the, when you look at the website and then you see, okay, for example, mycology, parasitology, we see like in this day and age, microbiology is becoming very centralized, right? So you either might be working in a smaller facility where you do a little bit of testing. And if you go to a big place, maybe they hire you to work in bacteriology only, or so you don't get that exposure to mycology or mycobacteria. So that's a question. So how can you satisfy these requirements if you're only, besides, you know, mainly restricted to one area and still be able to take this certification?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I'm so glad you asked me that, because this is one that has come up recently for discussion, and one we actually talked about at the Board of Certification. So when you look at that experience route and the experience documentation, it really has a couple of basic requirements. And one is that you must demonstrate competency, not proficiency, competency in moderate and high complexity testing, which if you're doing the Gram stain, you're doing high complexity testing. So really, you know, anyone who spent any time in a microbiology lab with a sufficient, test menu is going to be doing this type of testing. And the other piece is that you need to be competent in all of the tests and procedures for 3 out of 6 areas. So to be eligible, competency in 3 out of 6. So those areas are bacteriology, molecular microbiology, mycology, mycobacteriology, parasitology, and virology. So that gets really confusing quickly if you're a lab, like you mentioned, that sends out their mycology and their mycobacteriology. And a lot of labs aren't doing traditional parasitology and virology anymore. A lot of virology has just been gobbled up by molecular microbiology. But each of those areas has specific components like QC and troubleshooting, and it actually will list where you could do observations or you could do case studies. I should have kept that sheet right in front of me, but you don't have to directly be doing direct observation of every piece of the puzzle. It's recognized that not everybody is going to have the opportunity to do that. I will say, just because you didn't view something specifically to become eligible for the exam doesn't mean you need to know about it. You know, if your laboratory doesn't perform mycology, it doesn't mean that you're never going to be tested on mycology. So keep that in mind. I definitely don't want to give people the impression, but to become eligible, it's a much more reasonable pathway. So I don't want people to worry. Read that carefully, but it's meant to have that flexibility so that we still maintain that high level of quality, but we're not keeping people out of laboratory eligibility that, you know, just didn't have a chance to see virology testing in their lab. I hope that's a helpful explanation, because I think this is a confusing area. And the document used to say proficiency. And so we had a lot of discussion about what did that mean, competency versus proficiency. And proficiency to us meant I can perform this test by myself. And competency is more along the lines, I've seen this, I understand the principles, I'm ready to begin. And so we really wanted to be careful about that wording so that people weren't excluded, just on a technical term.
Okay, yeah, definitely it clarifies a lot. And for the listeners, definitely take the time to read it carefully. And you know, and it makes sense. I've seen this with other certifications, like for example, like here in the state of Florida, that like you have to be licensed. And you know, in my career, I met people that, for example, for let's say supervisor license, and then they're supervising microbiology. You know for a fact that they haven't worked in there, but I guess there are some requirements here and there that they can take and then still get the certification. So it makes sense. And I think, and I'm not going to ask you, but I think I read, and I'm inviting the listeners to, there's also an educational component. So if you teach it, that kind of also, it kind of qualifies you in one of the routes. I haven't read it in a while, but I think that's the case.
Yes, that's correct. And I also haven't memorized the routes either, because I think they are a little bit confusing. I know you asked me before about the routes and we said we would kind of go back to it. And I do think it is confusing. And they're really just describing those different components. And I think the BOC has very carefully tried to make that clear for different experience, training, education, and all of those combinations. And every once in a while, someone will bring something forward and say, I have X, Y, and Z pieces of the puzzle, am I eligible? And then those routes will get reviewed. So that's where you've seen them expand, why there are six routes, because you know, the standards are really high and those requirements are specific, but the way people acquire all of those pieces can be really different. So like you said, education, it is a route to get to teaching, is a route to get to some of those, to fulfill some of those requirements. So you're exactly right. And there's a little, I think there's a little helper on the website, which I actually think is a chat bot that can help you navigate your way through the routes. I have this and that, and then which route can I go through? So I think there's really an effort to try to help people navigate that process.
Okay. And as far as the exam, you know, what can you tell us about it? And of course, you know, that brings also the question, right? If the event that, you know, you prepared, unfortunately, you don't pass it, you know, which happens, is there a waiting period for retaking it?
Yeah, I think the waiting period, I hope I'm right about this. I think it's 3 months. So if you don't pass, I think you have to wait a little bit of a time. That's a good thing. Probably need to go practice a little bit. What I want to tell everyone about the exam, which I thought this was really exciting when I found out about this, is that ASCP uses a computer adaptive testing model. So that means the test questions vary with the difficulty and level and order of the questions you get asked, depending on how you do. So it can get harder or get easier or shift from this to that, depending on how you answer. That means most people aren't taking the same test, right? So the person you're sitting next to isn't getting the same test you are. And that also means there's no specific number or percentage people will ask, like what percentage of question or what, you know, I have to do 70% or I have to answer 60 questions correct. And I don't think it works that way. There's pass points that are set based on several factors. And I can't explain exactly how computer adaptive testing works in terms of scoring. But it means it's not as black and white as people want. And I know when people are preparing, they really want the answers. Well, how many things do I have to get right? And I guess my advice would be to really just prepare broadly for the field of microbiology, that solid knowledge. And it's a lot easier to say on this side of the process, right? When you've taken exams and you're done and you don't have to do that. So I definitely want to acknowledge how much anxiety goes in. You know, you've put all this effort in and you want to do a good job. So,
yeah, I can definitely attest to that. And I took mine for the MLS 11 years ago, and it was computerized. and you know, starts asking questions. And I think there's something about the intensity, and as you get them wrong, and there's some component to that. But I do know that, and a lot of people kind of agree with this, that I didn't have any idea. I didn't know if I passed or not before I actually hit that button. I'm like, okay, this question's, you know, what's happening here? And that is one of the scariest feelings in life. It's just like your brain just stops, and when you hit that key and waiting, but when you see that pass, it's like, oh yes, you know, I mean, I'm done. So it's a great feeling, definitely.
But you know, one thing that's been really great for me with getting to work with the Board of Certification and working on the exam committee is we can see how carefully reviewed the questions are, and how are people doing on the question, and are the people who are doing well on the exams answering this question correctly? Because if the people who are scoring really high on a lot of questions are not doing the, you know, picking the wrong answers, it could be part of what's how the question is written. And so those get looked at and revised. They get updated based on what's being currently practiced in the field. And so there's a whole process that goes into looking at that exam and making sure it's suited for the field and really of high quality, and testing, you know, what's relevant to the field, not just esoteric little pieces of knowledge that really aren't important to daily practice. It's meant to really, you know, guarantee that level of quality and training. So I thought that was a really neat behind the scenes piece of the puzzle I got to learn when working with the Board of Certification.
Yeah, it definitely sounds interesting. And you know, you definitely have shed a lot of light into this, and I hope the listeners, you know, they like this and they enjoy it. For me personally also, because as I said, you know, I kind of toyed with the idea of taking it, but doing other things, I haven't gotten to it. So learning more about it has been great also. Is there anything else that you want to add or talk about?
Yeah, I think there's two other things I wanted to make note of. One, and I forgot to mention before, there's a list of topics that are really covered. And so if you're going on to take the specialist exam, it'll show you those extra topics that would be covered on the specialist exam in addition to, you know, the standard MLS exam or categorical exam. So that's a good place to start if you're thinking about taking the specialist exam, to look at that. And the second thing, and I think probably this is something you already know, but I wanted to just share with the audience, is that you know, talking about the Board of Certification and the importance of certification, we really want to highlight this current effort to standardize the nomenclature for the field. And when we're referring to ourselves as certified laboratory professionals, that we're saying we're calling ourselves medical laboratory scientists in our field as laboratory professionals, rather than med techs or bench techs or lab techs. And I realized too that MLS is not as easy to say as lab tech or med tech, right? That's very short, but you know, med lab scientists or MLS, you know, as you mentioned, we're a field that's not always visible in the healthcare field. And if we continue to kind of refer to each other in different ways, it's even harder to raise the visibility for our field. And there, you know, we want to let people know there's a significant amount of training that goes into this. There's a significant amount of expertise that goes into performing our work. And so standardizing our nomenclature as in our field is one way we can promote our field and raise visibility and help everyone understand, you know, what we do. So that's one major initiative that's really coming out of this certification process. So I hope folks are really getting on board with that. And that's a little bit of why I wanted to share the history of how we went from medical technician to medical technologist, and now we're medical laboratory scientists, or, you know, microbiologists in the field. So
definitely, I completely agree. And I mentioned this before on the podcast, and I think a lot of effort has been put into the whole visibility factor, and you know, definitely programs are making use a lot of social media. You know, they're hitting high schools, you know, colleges, they're doing summer immersion. So I think, you know, they definitely have increased the effort. So it makes me very happy to see that there's more activity in raising the awareness about what we do, you know, which is such an important work, and our contribution to, you know, to the patients and to medicine, it's immense. So
yeah, I agree. And it is really fun to see new people come into the field. And I really like when we have, you know, the MLS students in the lab, or we've had some undergrads come over and just show them the laboratory. And it's really fun to share what we do.
Definitely. Well, you know, as Dr. Harrington, you know, I really want to thank you for taking the time. Once again, I said, you know, you have shed a lot of light into this, and this is really good for our profession. So thank you for taking the time to being Let's Talk Micro.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I feel really honored to be here today and to get to talk to you about this, and just to get a chance to have your audience hopefully get a better understanding of how to navigate all of this, because I think it can be a little bit confusing.
Indeed, my pleasure. And for the listeners, you'll find once again, you know, the links in the show notes so you can research this information in more detail. And that, my dear audience, it's the end of this episode. I hope you enjoy learning about the ways that you can be certified in microbiology, in this case from the ASCP. As always, I enjoy sharing this information with you. And please, continue bringing that passion to what you do. It's so important. You do such great work. Thank you for the support. Thank you for listening. And of course, stay tuned. Great things coming your way. So, as always, stay motivated, stay safe, and of course, continue talking micro. Until the next time. Bye.